This is a continuation of the oral history interview with Professor Christopher Coe, February 28th, 2007. Chris, when we left off the last time, we were talking about your arrival here, stabilizing the lab, and what I would like to do now is review your research program from that point until today.
When I first arrived at the primate lab, the focus of my research was on how do psychological factors, including stress, influence immune responses, and a special aspect of that research for me was concerned with the developing infant, because I viewed then and still do view that the young individual, children, infants, are the ones that are particularly vulnerable to having inhibited immune responses and becoming sick from alterations in their immune responses. And so I began by evaluating the kinds of immune changes that occur in young baby monkeys when they're weaned from the mothers, either by the mother naturally or by a human, weaning it off into a different social group. And there were many significant immune changes that occurred at that time, some of which would actually make them more vulnerable to illness. As the years went on, we began to study other aspects of the development of immunity in young animals. What would happen if they hadn't been breastfed? What would happen if they were raised in a nursery by humans? And we found that each of these changes in the course of their development and how they were reared did have an effect on different components of the immune system. In some cases, irreversible changes. If they were raised in a nursery away from their mother, that their immune system would develop differently than if they had been breastfed naturally by the mother, and you couldn't reverse that. If it went on for 6 or 12 months, they were now stamped irreversibly and charted in a certain direction, and they would stay that way 3-4 years later. They still had different immune responses.
When you say different, does that mean weaker?
Weaker and abnormal, such that the numbers and types of cells, in this case we were studying a type of lymphocyte, the T lymphocytes, the helper and suppressor cells, and the ratio would become abnormal if they weren't raised by their mother, and it would just stay abnormal. So day in, day out, every day of their lives, about as far as we followed them, which was till 4 years of age, they would have a different pattern of cells in circulation, such that when we took a blood sample and put it in culture and grew up the cells, the response would be atypical because you had different numbers of cells as compared to a healthy, normal animal. And what we began to realize as we were doing those kinds of studies is the closer to birth one intervened or altered the course of development, the larger the differences and the more long-lasting they were. Whereas in a grown-up, an adult, human or an adult monkey, when it's stressed or experiences something, it changes. It changes for an hour or a day, but it comes back to a certain set point, its original place of starting. When you derail a young animal that doesn't have these regulatory set points, that's not fully mature and regulated yet, you actually cause some long-lasting changes, in some cases irreversible. So following that logic and interest in moving earlier in development, we became interested in studying potentially even earlier perturbations which might occur in fetal life before a baby was even born. And that's still the topic we study today, which is, can experiences by the mother, can events that are happening in the outside world, even as the fetus is developing, begin to change the path that it will be on, such that at the moment of birth, it's already set, if you will, towards a certain destiny. And that's the topic I work on today, 20 years after arrival. The effects of maternal nutrition during pregnancy, the effects of stress or hormone exposure during pregnancy, the diet she's eating, and how does that influence the development of the fetus, such that it comes out into the world, even on day one, already started in a certain direction, which will either be reinforced or not by the kind of world it finds itself in.
It's just so fascinating. Now, when you talk about the fetal development, how do you correct for genetic predisposition? You know, some people are healthier than others.
Well, I could give you a personal example as a sort of a case report of that kind of question. So obviously there is a strong interaction with genetics, familial history. So in my family, I have one child that's allergic to nuts and one child that's not allergic to nuts. Turns out nut allergies actually begin in fetal life, so that if a woman eats lots of certain kinds of nuts during her pregnancy and happens to be gestating, carrying a baby who is genetically predisposed to allergies, particularly nut allergies, it will become manifest in part because some of those peanut proteins are crossing the placenta and influencing the baby even before the moment of birth. My wife, and that's why this is a relevant example, my wife ate nuts through both of those pregnancies, the first and the second. One child came out perfectly fine, has no allergies, can eat nuts in a perfectly healthy manner. The other child will die, will develop anaphylactic shock. So your question about genetics is certainly true. Some of us are at risk already at the genetic level, and then the environment comes along and plays on that. Some of us not. And the same is true for each of the other kinds of topics that I study. So some individuals are more at risk for stress and high stress reactions. Some of us are more prone to heart disease. Some of us are predisposed to immune disorders. So that it is the interaction between nature and nurture, and that's a topic I've been interested in my whole career.
Now, in our first session, you were talking about your undergraduate work, or your graduate work, where you were in medical school, but you weren't getting a medical degree. And I think I'm correct in remembering that you were predisposed to the new information that you are developing. You want to find a practical use for that. How do you manage that? How have you managed that during your career as really quite a prominent psychologist, and all of this work that you're doing with monkeys? Are you besieged by people who say, what does this mean for me? How are we going to use this data?
Well, there are people who ask me that, and I ask myself that same question in a variety of different ways. I have to ask myself that question when I write a grant application. I certainly have to answer that question for myself as I write the first paragraph of any article, as well as the last paragraph of any article, in terms of what is the big picture, how does one frame the relevance of the question. And these days, because animal research is under such scrutiny, in addition, I have to answer that question for the Animal Care and Use Committee that evaluates a project, and I have to be prepared to answer that question for the lay public, for the journalist. On multiple levels, I address it personally for myself, as well as in anticipation of having to give an answer to others as well.
You're kind of a hybrid, aren't you? You're a pure researcher, but you're also an applied researcher.
I could give an example which I think addresses exactly that question. So one type of prenatal condition or influence that we study is the influence of maternal diet during pregnancy on the kind of baby that she will have and how that baby will develop. The dietary factor that we became interested in is iron. How does maternal iron and her diet influence the amount of iron a baby will be born with? The reason we became interested in iron is it is the leading nutrient deficiency worldwide. It's estimated that over 1 billion people on the planet are anemic.
Really?
If women are anemic, they then go on then to have anemic iron deficient babies. So when you ask about the broad relevance, yes, I'm studying iron and anemia in monkeys. On one level, one might say, well, that's interesting, but who cares? My response to that is, well, there are over 1 billion people on the planet who care about the consequences of iron deficiency. And the reason we would care as pediatricians or parents is you need iron to develop normally. If you have insufficient amounts of iron, you can't oxygenate your blood. If you have insufficient amount of iron, you can't make certain brain chemicals that are critical. Iron is needed to make the white sheath, the myelin that coats neurons and makes them fire better. Iron is needed to make dopamine, an important neurotransmitter. So what starts as a basic science question, how does iron get across the placenta to a baby monkey has relevance to third world people who are undernourished. It has relevance even to every parent in terms of knowing, should I give an iron supplement to my child if it's anemic at 4 or 6 or 8 months of age? So yes, I do weigh, in choosing what to study, I have a finite number of hours in each day, I do weigh, oh, well, I'm interested in flu, I'm interested in anemia, I'm interested in stress. So I pick and choose which topics to study based in part on the answer to your question.
Now, in the late 80s, when you're starting this research here, are you have you secured major federal support at this point?
For a variety of reasons. One is I needed research monies for myself and my lab, but as we talked about earlier, I was under the gun to ensure that there was new money coming into the primate lab itself.
Yes.
So I started from day one seeking funding, obtaining funding, and in short order, within a year or two of arrival, I had 2 grants, not one. And for most of the time I've been here, I've run 2 monkey grants, and then simultaneously, and then about 5 to 10 years into the process, certainly by the early 90s, I was also doing human research as well. And since the mid-90s, I've always kept monkey research going in parallel with human research. And today, half of my research actually involves human participants, not animals.
Huh. Interesting.
So there's the persona of me as the head of the lab and the guy who does all the research in baby monkeys, but I also do studies in this area of psychoneuroimmunology with respect to a number of human conditions in humans. So we've studied asthmatic teenagers and the effects of stress on their airways and on immune response. We've studied individuals who had cerebral palsy and post-stroke. We've studied people with psychological disorders, post-traumatic stress disorder, depression. My most recent work over a 5-year period of time was chronic pain disorders for women with fibromyalgia.
Uh-huh.
And to what extent could we find immune abnormalities in women with chronic pain conditions?
It's just, it's almost breathtaking, the spectrum of areas that you've worked on. You must be quite a curious person. You must have a wide range of interests.
Yeah, or else attention deficit disorder. Or
I was trying to toss you a softball compliment there.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I've been very fortunate to have excellent people to work with.
Uh-huh.
One of the tricks of working on so many different topics is to work with outstanding collaborators. And UW is very rich in its breadth and depth. And every time one goes looking for a colleague who can help you out, you discover they're often the world's expert. And so when I was working on asthma, I was fortunate to work with one of the leading allergists in the country, William Bussey, over at the med school. And so he facilitated my ability to work with asthmatic individuals and to evaluate lung function. I've worked with people from the counseling psych department when we were doing studies of women who had been sexually abused as children. So I guess it speaks more to my ability to work in a collegial, cooperative manner with others. Now, when I do flu research, I work with one of the flu virologists over from the vet school, and so he assists us in growing up the virus and quantifying the infections. And I guess that's been an attribute of my work, and increasingly I guess of everybody's work in modern science, is that it's become much more of a team effort than it was when everybody used to work in their own mom and pop way in their individual lab.
Is it fair to say then that you have been pleased with the intellectual community at UW-Madison in terms of who you needed?
I can't imagine having asked for much more than that. Every time I look around,
really,
it just happened today. We're starting a new study where we're need to be able to administer to monkeys label iron so we could actually quantify how much iron is getting up into their red blood cells and how much is crossing the placenta to the baby. And we were wondering how we would be able to make this iron up in a sterile way. And we discovered the pharmacy department has a service, what they call the experimental station, where that's exactly what they see as their mission, to assist people who need to make up pharmaceuticals or agents for administering to humans or to animals. And every time I've ever had that kind of need at UW, I have been successful in finding just the right colleague, and as I said, sometimes the world's expert on that topic.
So, it, you know, it's certainly said commonly that the UW-Madison is a world-class university, when, and that's almost become a catchphrase. I take it from what you say that, in fact, the reality is that the university is world-class. You don't have to stay at Stanford or go to Harvard.
I'm embarrassed to admit I didn't fully appreciate its breadth and depth when I came here. I mean, I knew it was an important school. I had no idea that it really had the caliber of people that it does have.
Really?
To illustrate, and I should be embarrassed to tell this story, but during my job interviews, that was still the time when the airport was not quite as developed, and you would get off the plane and walk down the stairs. And both of the times I came here, it was in the middle of snowstorms.
Oh, yeah.
And so I felt like I was coming into the hinterlands in the depths of Siberia. And so thinking, as I came here to set up my lab and research, that I was coming to this remote place, this small city, I was not sure I'd be able to buy all the medical and research supplies that I would need to do research. And so I pre-bought out in Stanford a lot of the supplies. As I look back on now, it's really kind of silly, but
really?
I shipped syringes and I shipped test tubes as if I would not be able to acquire them in the
wilds.
Primitive wilds of Madison, Wisconsin. I obviously realized soon after arrival that
yes.
was not the case at all, but I didn't fully appreciate on arrival, when I first landed here in 85, just what kind of a world-class institution it really is.
That's interesting. Now, returning to the subject of stress for a moment, is stress probably your fundamental interest?
It certainly was in the mid-80s. I've branched out considerably beyond the topic of stress. So, for example, my current grant with baby monkeys doesn't even have the word stress in it. It actually involves studying the effects of flu infections during pregnancy on the development of the baby's brain.
Uh-huh.
So nowhere in the abstract or title, the title, if I recall, is something like maternal flu infection and brain development in the young infant. I still study aspects of stress, and stress is a great overarching word to talk about the effects of different physical and psychological challenges, because one could think of a viral infection as a kind of a stressor. Or to say it in the way it probably really happened in the course of evolution, more primitive animals developed responses to challenge, to cold and heat, to an inability to get nutrition, to predators, and what happened over time was the stress response co-opted or uses many of those basic physiological systems.
Huh.
So what we call the stress response today to an emotional challenge is really the same biology that is the response to a physical challenge that evolved millennia ago. So there is a bit of a duality between a physical challenge, a viral challenge, undernutrition, or an emotional challenge.
Does it annoy you as a precise researcher when you read in the lay press the general, oh, that's stress, or that's stress, or the concept is tossed around everywhere?
Yeah, it doesn't bother me so much because I'm used to it, but it has been a common complaint in stress research for approximately, well, it's over 70 years now, 80 years, since the father of stress first wrote his articles. This was a man named Hans Selye in the 1930s. He's considered the father of the stress field. And even in 1932, he purposely avoided the use of the word stress because he said it has been so overused and as a consequence is so undefinable that he would avoid using it. But even he couldn't turn it around. He used a term, much more cumbersome term, called general adaptation syndrome.
This is tape number 3, side 1, Professor Christopher Coe, February 28, 2007. I was asking you about the popularization of the concept of stress. Does it distress you as an intellectual to hear a concept so misunderstood and so tossed around? Or doesn't it matter?
As I was saying before we switched to the new tape, this has been a recurrent issue in the stress field for decades, one that even the father of the term stress dealt with and tried to avoid and then returned to using the word stress himself. Within the scientific literature, one tries to use it carefully, and we, for example, attempt to make a distinction between the stimulus, or the stressor, and the response, which is the stress. But we're so used to seeing it used more broadly than that, the stress of modern life. I feel stressed.
Yes.
Even if they haven't actually measured a hormone or a white blood cell, we have a state that most of us would say, oh, that is when I am stressed. And as you carefully, in phrasing the question, said, I am distressed. When I teach my undergrads, because I have a class on the subject of stress, I compel them on the first couple of days to be very careful to, when they're describing the emotions and the feelings of stress, to use the word distress, for which we mostly mean tension and anxiety, sometimes depression, maybe muscle aches. That's the perception and the emotional coloring of stress, and to reserve the word stress for the biology. But that's only within the classroom setting, or when I'm writing an article, or within the lay public's use of the word. I use the word stress the way everybody else does. I feel stressed, or it's a stressful time of day.
Yeah. At what point in your general research program do you expand your parameters and move beyond stress?
There were aspects even early on in the late 80s which were pulling me in different directions. Soon after arrival, I began to work with a gerontologist whose name was William Ursler. He's not at the university anymore, but he convinced me that it would be just as interesting to study changes in biology and immunity at the end of the lifespan. So just as we have to develop an immune response and develop immune competence at the beginning, at the end of our lives, we have the mirror image and undergo a process called immune senescence, the going to sleep of the immune system, which in humans occurs between 60 and 80, 90 years of age. And so with Bill Ursler, I began to study the biology of aging, and to this day include some research and have one project where we look at old monkeys rather than young monkeys. And again, that project doesn't really involve the subject of stress at all, but it's another process, another factor that can change the competence of immunity. In this case, an intrinsic one, rather than an extrinsic. Stress, in a sense, is extrinsic, the world impinging upon us, but there are also internal processes that drive changes in immune health. And so I was beginning to do age-related studies by the late 80s and continued off and on to dabble in that. And one of the largest human studies that I have going on now is to serve as what's called the BioCore for a project that the woman at the Institute on Aging heads. Her name is Carol Riff. The project has the abbreviation called MIDAS, Midlife in the United States. It's a survey of health and biology of midlife in older humans. And that's an example of one of these human studies that I was referring to. And I serve as the BioCore, meaning that I oversee all of the biological measures for her study. So we measure cholesterol, and we measure some white blood cell measures, we measure cytokines, and so that interest in aging monkeys with Balershla translates now into an interest in aging people as I get older as well. And with Carol, she's the PI, I'm the helper. We just funded another study. We just got a grant to do a mirror image study of health and biological aging in Japan to compare how they age to how Americans are aging, and also to see if different cultural factors influence the biology of aging in Japan, because obviously it's a different culture than ours. So,
interesting.
This is sort of more of what we were talking about a few minutes ago. I'm not so immodest that I could possibly do all of this on my own. In some cases, I am the lead person. I am the PI who writes the grant and heads the project. In other cases, when it's out of my area of expertise, I'm more than happy to be the team player or the resource. So in what I was just talking about, MIDAS and what's called MIDJA, which is midlife in Japan, I'll be the support person as opposed to the PI.
Chris, we touched on the animal rights people in the first session. At this point in your career in the late 80s and early 90s, has their presence become problematical? Have you been starting to be vilified and attacked yet? Or is this still a bit of a nuisance?
I'll come back to the word nuisance, because I actually think the animal rights movement did us all a very important service. While there are days where I certainly would rather not be vilified, I would also say that one of the good things that came out of that was to make everybody who uses animals much more sensitive about some of the ethical concerns, where one should pause and ask, well, how distressing or disturbing is that for an animal? Have I really made the study as humane as possible? So I don't really mind the regulatory oversight which has come from that. And originally it began with the Animal Welfare Act, but there have been a number of congressional acts and NIH decisions that make this a much more regulated enterprise than it ever was. When I started in animal research, you pretty much did what you wanted. If you had an interest, you had an experiment in mind, you went up to your lab and you just did it. And nobody asked. And this is all the way back to 1975. Today, I have to submit a protocol which is as detailed, or probably more than the one that will go to an IRB for a human study.
Uh-huh.
The human research focuses mostly on the consent form. Since animals can't consent,
right,
you provide much more detail. So already by the late 80s, science was much more regulated. We were submitting protocols of the type I was just describing. And I think that was a good change and an appropriate change. And it certainly helped, I think, to reduce some of the perceptions that we were loose cannons, we were sadistic, uncaring in how we treated animals.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, there are still individuals, many, who would say that what I do today is still inhumane, inappropriate, and would identify me. There are people in the Madison animal rights community who would identify me as the bad guy, especially as the one who heads the HoloLab. Because if there's one person they don't like, well, there are quite a few they don't like, but if there's one guy that they look back upon and, you know, point the finger as an example of somebody who went too far, it's Howard Hollow. And so I picked up myself a negative spin the day I walked through this door and the day I put my name next to his.
Yeah.
I picked up a negative spin, and because of our street address and geographic location, when they have demonstrations in Madison, they typically make their way to our doorstep, even when they're going to protest somebody else. We're a very visible building, we're very easy to come by, and they like to have their picket lines, their demonstrations, right in front of our doorstep. So I have been, since the early 80s and right through every April, this April is when Animal Liberation Week comes.
Oh.
And so in a few more weeks, yes, you will be hearing my name again, or else something about primary research. And they will be here again, typically the third week of April.
Now, did that protest cause you, for lack of a better word, stress? Was it a more than a minor distraction?
I wouldn't call it a distraction. It's certainly an issue that I'm very cognizant of all the time.
Uh-huh.
I certainly teach my students to think about it, to be aware of it. It's a subject that's talked about with the staff who work here.
Yeah.
If somebody were to feel that a study we were doing was inhumane, they certainly should come to me. And if they felt they couldn't come to me, they actually are compelled by the regulations to go beyond me to one of these animal care and use committees to whistleblow and report, and that's part of the oversight. So it's an issue we all live with all the time, and there are some people who, as they work with animals, monkeys in particular, over time, begin to feel more uncomfortable about uh-huh. using them in studies. I draw my own lines. I generally avoid terminal research. Not that I feel terminal research is bad, but I don't like to do studies where at the end the outcome is a dead animal.
Uh-huh.
So I make decisions about what to study and how to study it to avoid having to do terminal research. But that's a personal decision. With regards to dealing with the animal rights movement per se, I've always felt that I should be able to defend, to justify what I do to others, including to them. I have a bit of a reputation for going out the door and actually speaking to the demonstrators.
You
sometimes
do?
to the distress of the local police, because they're concerned that it could aggravate the people out there.
Aren't you frightened?
I probably should be more frightened than I am. Maybe it's overly naive to think that if I talk in a reasonable manner that I will at least be able to convince them that I feel their opinions are valued, are acceptable. I don't expect to convince everybody to do animal research or even to like it. I usually today say that it's very analogous to many of the other complex ethical medical issues facing us, such as the right to life versus the right to have an abortion, end-of-life decisions, and euthanasia. Our relationship to animals is a very important one that
mm-hmm.
People should think about. And so one of the first things I say to them, which I believe that's not just baloney to say it to them, is I'm glad they're thinking about this issue. It's better than the people who don't even stop to pause and ask, is it okay to wear an animal? Is it okay to use an animal for research, for food, for entertainment? I think it is a decision that each person should come to a decision about. And then I go on to say, well, and I, after I reflected upon it, I drew a different conclusion. I do feel that it is reasonable to use a certain number, not unlimited numbers of animals, but a certain number of animals to advance knowledge, to cure disease. And I tried to convince them to respect, you know, my right to have come to that decision. And that part of that is that I'm compelled to do the research in a humane manner, at least as humanely as possible.
Yeah.
Given the nature of the experiment and how the animals have to live.
Over the years, has the university administration been a consistently and unwavering supporter of yours and the Harlow Lab?
I would have to give a mixed answer on that. And I would say with regards to this one topic, with regards to animal rights, I would say the university has been very strongly in support of researchers who use animals.
Uh-huh.
They recognize its role in modern science and in medicine. They recognize its importance in NIH-funded research. I mean, there is an element of it which is financial as well. If we would all abandon animal research, it would be a big financial blow to the university. having said that, any institution, including ours here at the UW, has to be concerned about subjects which become black eyes, problematic ones. And so if an individual researcher were to become a real liability, a chancellor would be crazy not to pause and say, boy, you know, that one lab, that one subject is really causing problems with the donors. That one subject, that one experiment is galvanizing the media to write terrible articles about the university. So I think not just the UW, but any institution has to be concerned about what to do with a controversial program of research, intellectual activity. It could be, it hasn't happened yet, but it could be that, you know, some studies would just be considered too controversial to be continued. We've had individual animal researchers, not me, not anyone from our lab, who have been sanctioned because it was felt that they violated a regulation significant enough that their research program should be at least interrupted, and in one case actually stopped. But that's never happened to me, or I would hope it won't happen to me, because I try to avoid ever doing anything which would put me in that kind of situation, which would includes thinking about the humane aspects of the study and being sure everyone's appropriately trained.
Do you feel like you're under, or do you feel like your research program is more carefully scrutinized in Bascom than, say, perhaps others?
Not by Bascom per se, but by the arms of Bascom, which are its representatives, which are the five animal care and use committees.
I see.
Which now get together in a grand committee. So we have the five committees for each college, and then they get together in what's called an all-campus animal use committee. And so in that sense, that committee happens coincidentally to meet in Bascom. So I suppose it does radiate down from Bascom. But the group that would more immediately oversee what I do is the LMS, Letters and Sciences Animal Care and Use Committee. So any experiment I do has to go through that committee. In addition, twice a year they come down and do on-site visual inspections and walk through. The veterinarian has as his charge or her charge to always do this every single day. So there's a fair amount of scrutiny. Contrary to what the animal rights people say, we're out behind closed doors, I'm doing things secretly.
Yeah.
That would be impossible today. The students see what I do, my staff sees what I do, the caretakers see, as well as all of these committees. And in the final analysis, there's no purpose for me to do a study that I don't report. If I just do an experiment on my own and keep the data in my file, I've accomplished nothing. So I have to at some point really make it public by actually writing up what I've done. So in truth, while they would like to come here, in here, and tear us apart and see everything we do, in fact, they are seeing everything we do. Hmm. Maybe not exactly the way they would like to, but they actually, by the time it's an article in the scientific journal, they've actually heard everything that we've done.
So at this point in your career, is it fair to say that you are content and secure with your ability to continue to work with animals as you need to?
I hedged a bit when you asked me, has the university done everything in its power to support me?
Yes.
And I paused and took a breath before I fully answered. So the HoloLab is entirely dependent upon NIH grant support or contracts from outside agencies. I would love to be able to tell you that if there was a shortfall in money, that as we're facing now, with tight money in Washington, that the university would rescue me, would guarantee our existence. In truth, I don't think it would, nor maybe can it or should it. So we are entirely dependent upon the lab will rise and fall with my success and the couple of other investigators here.
With NIH?
With the NIH, because we're dependent upon federal support. And we don't have a safety blanket in the sense we don't, a safety, I mean, a safety blanket either. We don't have a safety net, which is that should there be a serious shortfall, not a minor one, but a serious shortfall over a sustained period of time, I would be facing the same issue I faced in 1985, which is I would have to go to the university and say, I just can't do it anymore. In this climate, I just can't get enough grant dollars. So I'm still writing grants on a regular basis, looking for new types of studies and new areas of funding, as I was in 1985 when I first arrived.
Mm-hmm.
It's my hope and expectation I can sustain that for another 9 years.
And maybe this is a good question to ask now. Given the current anti-intellectual climate in America, as reflected in Congress and the current administration, how concerned are you about the future of federal funding for basic research like yours and everyone's, actually?
It is definitely a period of time where there is a lot of evolution in what's going to be supported. My own area of research is not quite as vulnerable as other areas. There are definitely people in the social sciences who are already feeling the hit and feeling the influence of the government that's in power right now. If one has the word, I've heard this, I think I can say from official sources, if you have the word sex in your title or in your abstract to your grant application, it will go downtown, so to speak. And it will be evaluated beyond scientific merit as to whether or not there's interest in seeing that kind of research funded. My own studies have not had that kind of scrutiny, and I'm hoping, for example, my decision to study flu was very opportune, as we hear about avian flu,
right.
And so I came in with that particular application just as there was a huge amount of new interest in flu, and actually it was... Not only did it get a good score, but the funding was pretty much assured because right at this moment, there's a lot of interest in flu. And so part of what it takes to be in this business and to do the kind of higher level, higher funded research that I do is to keep your eye on what's topical, what's not of interest. Many of my colleagues who try to just keep doing the same thing over and over, or just a permutation of that, will find themselves in this time period on the sidelines, because there are whole topic areas which are dropping off the map.
Interesting. Now, you talked about, and I'd like to hear you talk about more about your movement into flu. You also did some work on HIV, didn't you?
Yes.
And when was that, and how did you get into that?
Well, we touched, I think, earlier, either on tape or off tape, about the role that all of the AIDS-related monies in the 80s had in stimulating the development of the field of psychoneuroimmunology, because that really gave us a reason for being concerned about, well, could emotions promote health?
Yes.
Would it matter if you were fatalistic after you had an HIV diagnosis? Or would it make a big difference if you were optimistic or had a purpose in life? If you were Magic Johnson and you had got an HIV diagnosis but you had a reason to live, is that why somebody survives 10 years or 20 years and another person succumbs quickly? So that's always been an important driver in my field. So that was a sort of always in the background as a sort of raison d'etre. Why do we care about PNI and emotions and health? But along the way, periodically, I've actually done some specific SIV research, which is the monkey equivalent of that. Monkeys have a virus, which is just like HIV.
It's
SIV, simian immunodeficiency virus.
Oh.
And so we actually did some studies looking at how the virus gets into the nervous system and what kinds of changes happen, because one of the very scary things about HIV and SIV is it doesn't just affect white blood cells, it can get up into the brain and change brain functioning. And so we actually did some studies, hands-on studies, with a local virologist, SIV HIV researcher for a period of time.
Are you doing anything with AIDS anymore?
No, not because I'm not interested. It's just because there are only so many hours in the day, and I haven't been approached in recent years by somebody who says, you know, I have this project ongoing. I'm really interested in depression lifestyle, or to put it in a more positive way, I'm interested in whether meditation can help a person who has AIDS to live better, be healthier.
Yes.
I would do a study of that type, and that's a typical kind of study that I do. But right now, as you've commented on, I have more on my plate than is probably reasonable for any one researcher.
Yes. Now, talk. When did you pick up flu then?
So in the course of doing studies on stress and looking for ways to evaluate monkeys in terms of did they have a good immune system or a bad immune system, we began to use flu as our outcome measure. So rather than the experimental parameter, it was actually on the other end. And so we would give monkeys flu and ask the question, are you very good or poor at fighting off the flu virus? Does it stay in you for 1 day, 3 days, 7 days, or 14 days? And we would use the duration of the infection and how severe it was as our index of whether a monkey had a good or a bad immune system. So in the course of doing that, we became quite competent ourselves in working with flu, handling it, evaluating the infection. And I was aware of this controversial issue in the literature, which was, how dangerous is flu for a pregnant woman? Sitting in the psychological and psychiatric literature has been for decades this lingering concern that maybe one factor which causes a child to develop a neurodevelopmental disorder like autism or ADHD or dyslexia was a fetal infection, a viral infection. And even stronger than that is the link between viral infection and schizophrenia. So
really?
If a woman has a flu infection during pregnancy, a bad one, not a mild one, it increases by a factor of about 8 the risk that her child will grow up and develop schizophrenia. There's about an 8-fold increase in risk. Not guaranteed, but it's just a higher risk. And that sort of linkage has been confirmed in rodent models, mice and rats, where rats and mice are not humans, they're a long way from humans. They have a different placenta, they don't really get infected with flu the same way, and so it occurred to me that I was the right guy to actually do the in-between study, the animal model study, that would link up these two literatures. The human literature is sort of epidemiological, often retrospective. What they'll do is go into a population of schizophrenics and try to retrospectively find out whether their mothers had the flu during pregnancy. Obviously, that's a hard study to do. So what we're doing now is prospectively infecting monkeys with flu at different points in pregnancy. Then when the babies are born, we let them grow up for a year, and then we use modern neuroimaging techniques to scan their brains and see whether their brains show some of the abnormalities that you find in a schizophrenic brain.
Which
in this case is a reduction in gray matter and an enlargement of the, what they call the ventricle space where the fluid is, the CSF. And I'm sorry to report, because in some ways we'd be able to have a negative finding. We have a positive finding, which is that flu infections during pregnancy do in fact create a monkey with a brain which shows a deviation in that direction, less gray matter and enlarged ventricles. I mean, that's what we're working on now.
This concludes side one of tape three. This is side two of tape three. When did that flu work begin? A year.
My own personal? So we've been using flu, as I said, as an outcome measure for about 5 years, so that's since the year 2000. But the actual study that I was last speaking about, which is there a risk of getting the flu during pregnancy, that just began this year. So the grant, we're just starting the second year. It was funded in December 2000. 5 is when we started.
Chris, one of the projects that you worked on that was in your file up in Bascom concerned the crush at Camp Randall during a football game in the 1994 fall season that apparently was quite dramatic and that you had to do some work on that. What was that?
So I'm, if you will, the go-to guy on campus if one has an interest in psychoneuroimmunology or being able to include immune measures in a psychological type of study. I'm often the one that a person would be approached, and this particular incident was very big in Madison, very important in Madison. People were injured. It affected the students. Just to briefly summarize for the future, in case it's not known, this was a big game where we were playing Michigan. At the time, there was a tradition of rushing the field at the end of the game if you won, and you would tear down the goalposts. And there was a student section in the stadium that would typically all push forward, surge forward, and tear down the goalposts. The problem at this particular game was that it occurred so quickly and there was a barricade that the students were all piled on top of one another. It was essentially a crowd mob kind of incident, and none of the students in the back were aware of how many students were piling onto one another at the front of the student section. And by the time it was all over, there were about 70 injured students. A few, quite seriously, there was one woman who was briefly in a coma.
Oh, really?
So this was a big deal. And at the time this occurred, I had a student who was interested in post-traumatic stress disorder. That is the long-term reaction to a traumatic event. And so in part because this was so topical, this incident at the football stadium, in part because of this interest in PTSD, we were interested in whether the students who were caught up in that crush, or the ones who were the culprits, if you will, who were at the back of the crowd, how they would react over time. And typically when one does that type of study, you wait a few months following the incident and then evaluate the students. So we evaluated students who had been injured at the front of the pack. We evaluated students who were behind, who were not hurt themselves, but were part of the causation. And what I thought made it a fascinating study was there's a second student section at Camp Randall, which is across the field. And so there were eyewitnesses who were neither hurt nor the culprits. They were on the other side of the stadium with visual witnesses of what had happened, of what had unfolded. And so we recruited several months later. This happened, I believe, in November. We evaluated them over January and February. How many were showing signs of post-traumatic stress disorder? We also took blood samples from students who would be willing. And we did a typical kind of psychoneuroimmunology study. It involved about 75 students. And then we had also controls who had never been at the game at all. So I thought it was a fascinating study. It got into the papers, and the important message in some ways was that our students were very resilient. Even the ones who were injured were not showing signs of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Really?
In part because there also had been an intervention set up. The health clinics and counseling psych program had set up resources for any students who were feeling that they were having reoccurrences, were having... The definition of post-traumatic stress disorder would involve intrusive thoughts and avoidant behavior, meaning you won't go to football games again, you won't watch football on TV, and a sort of generalized arousal, meaning that you're just anxious all the time, you can't sleep, you're feeling tense. And so one of the good parts of that study was demonstrating that this age group of students, in part maybe because they're this age, in part because of the support from other students, were not experiencing signs of post-traumatic stress disorder 3 months later, neither psychologically nor physiologically when we looked at their blood. So that was good. It got into the newspapers. It got a little notoriety, not for me so much, but for my graduate student and the social psych, clinical psych guy I was working with, Tim Straumann. Because we didn't have the big headline negative finding of PTSD, we actually had a lot of trouble at publishing it. And in fact, it never got published despite being submitted to two different journals because it was somewhat anticlimactic from their point of view, that it didn't have the result of we find PTSD in students who were caught up in the crush. So the good news for the students was bad news for us from the point of view of getting another publication.
Yellow journalism sells even in scholarly journals, yeah. Huh?
So it still sits in my files. I still have a copy of the manuscript, but it has never been published. I'll probably one day weave it into a book chapter or something else of that sort. I have gone to meetings on trauma where I've shown the results, but I've never had an opportunity to actually put it into writing.
Chris, as I think about your work in the 90s, leading to, I'm on teaching now, you got the Chancellor's Teaching Award in 1997. How did you integrate your research into your teaching? You must be, there are very few of you who get the Chancellor's Teaching Award. It's quite an honor, I think.
No, I was very flattered, and if you ask me to say what will matter most, what will have the most lingering influence of my career, I would probably say the effect I've had on students, my role in the classroom more than my publications. When I came here, I inherited a class which was not quite as large as it is today called Animal Behavior of the Primates. It was a topic area that was perfect for me because it was a subject I knew about, and so it was a class that I could inherit without having to prep from scratch. Over the years, I've sort of modified it, blended it to become, I think, quite a unique one, probably one of the kind in the whole country, because it spans animal behavior, ethology, all the way through to biomedical issues with primates, such as AIDS. I talk about AIDS and where did AIDS come from. I talk about the ethics of using animals in research and the ethics of our relationship to animals in general. I use it as a forum, talk about any topic one can imagine. Do chimps have culture? What have we learned by teaching chimps sign language and computer use? While maybe it's I deserve some credit in terms of my ability to be a teacher, I think the subject matter teaches itself. I think students are hungry to learn this material. There's a huge groundswell, especially right now, to save the earth. I think it's a topic of class for these times. And so it has grown. This semester it's 350 students.
So this is more than psychology majors.
Oh, far more. It's used by the psych students as one of their electives as they're not entering the major, moving up in the major, but it's also used as the one science class for the majors where they have to just take a science class. So students from the humanities take it, journalism students, business students take it. So there are a large number of students take it as the one class in science that they will take. It's sort of their science biological literacy class, and that's great. I mean, so
you don't mind that?
On the contrary, it's a service class, and for many, then I reach out to a group of individuals I would never have contact with, that would never see me. And it's fun. I mean, over a period of 4 years, if you think about a four-year curriculum, I reach 1,400 students every 4 years. I mean, a significant portion of the student body through this class.
What are your requirements in that class? What do they have to do?
Well, it is a large class, and so it has the downside for them, I suppose, of being a large lecture class. But
300, you said?
350.
Wow.
So there's no way to personalize it per se, although I point out to them on the first day, I'm going to make this very personal, which starts out by me instructing them to look at their behind in the mirror and inquire what happened to their tail. and and other, as I say to them, and other major and important questions will be answered for you in this class, such as where did we come from, and why are humans aggressive, and why do we eat the kinds of foods we eat, and what is a natural food for a human being? Are we really vegetarians at heart? Is being vegetarian a unique diet in the primate order? What is monogamy and where did it come from? Were our ancestors really monogamy? So when I go and talk about those kinds of subjects, you can see why I'm getting the ratings I'm getting. So I think it's a very important subjects for students to learn about. I teach it more as a human biology class than a primate biology class. They learn a lot about primates. In the first month, they just took their first test a week ago. I do make them learn to recognize the primates by sight. There are 10 slides which come up on the first exam, and they have to be able to say who we're looking at. As I tell them, they will astound family and friends when they next go to the zoo, because they will look at that primate and say, that is a squirrel monkey or a lemur or a gorilla. And there's a map of the world, so there are flags around the world, and they have to say which primate lives in Madagascar and Sri Lanka and Borneo. There are matching questions where there's this primate and that primate, and they have to say which is the most closely related to one another, and on and on and on. And so the requirements are 3 exams, pretty hard memorization exams, and as I tell them on the first day, a willingness to learn this. If they don't,
are there TA sessions with this class?
There is a TA, not TA sessions. One of the things that's changed over the last generation and 2 generations is we don't have as many TAs as we had before. So this class has a 25% TA, not a 50% TA. And so what she does, it's a she this semester, is she meets with them to go over their exams. She's available at office hours if they have questions. She helps proctor the exams and helps in grading. But the ability to break up a large class of this type into sections and meet, we just don't have that kind of TA support. So no, there are no sections. It would be probably a good class to have a 1-hour breakout section in, but we don't have it.
Now, so how many lectures a week? Is this 2 or 3?
It's 2 of what they call the power lectures, the 75-minute lectures.
I can't imagine standing in front of 350 19 or 20-year-olds and talking for 75 minutes, but you must enjoy it.
Well, you have to project. It does require a certain amount of energy and practice. It's a mixture of engaging the audience, projecting to the audience, keeping it topical, thinking of a joke every once in a while, periodically, even in a large class like this, stopping and saying, any questions? If they don't have a question, asking them a question.
Oh, you do take questions during a lecture?
Not only do I take questions, I demand questions, because when I pause and do that, if I look out over this sea of blank faces, I go on to say, so you mean I can ask you on the next exam which primate moves slowly? And then I force somebody to give the answer. That is a Pato, or a Loris, or a Galago, or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And so I punctuate the class that way, and I use the last 15 minutes for all visual. So in addition to the visual materials that go on throughout the first hour, the last 15 minutes are all illustrations of things that have been talked about. It might be a video, it might be slides.
So you teach this course every year?
Every spring semester.
Every spring semester.
As I started this semester, I realized this was my 21st rendition, and assuming I stay for another 9 years, I'll probably
continue to
hit 30 before I'm done.
Really? What else do you teach? What other courses?
So I alternate typically between fall and spring, between a small class and a large class, so I don't get stale, obviously, if I taught the same subject over and over again, taking a break helps to not get stale in teaching it. And so in the fall, I teach an upper-level elective We have what are called 411s, which are these smaller seminar style classes, and the one I typically teach is called the Psychobiology of Stress and Coping.
Stress and coping?
Stress and coping. And so it's, what is stress? What are the stress related ailments? Asthma, ulcers, heart disease, diabetes. And then I teach about coping with stress, so that's stress management techniques, changes in outlook. Don't sweat the small stuff, it's all small stuff. Stop and smell the roses, all the sort of sayings that we have.
Yes. Now, do you maintain office hours for both of these courses?
And they can meet anytime. I always tell them, they can email me, they can arrange to meet anytime. But typically I have office hours the hour after lecture. Some students take advantage of that, some mostly they don't. If they get bad grades, they take advantage of it, at least right after the exam.
I'm just curious on grading. How tough a grader are you?
You'd have to ask them to get the answer. I would say I consider myself tough but fair. But in a class of this size, I do give out C's and I do give out some D's. So it has a bell-shaped curve in a big class of 350, tilted more towards the B, AB distribution. There's been great inflation over the years. A C now is considered a horrible, horrible grade. That would be like failing somebody back when you and I were in school, because they were all trying to go on, and so a C is... It's hard to give people much below a C.
Chris, let me redirect your attention now to the Department of Psychology, and have you make some observations about the department, its growth, how it's changed between you've been here more than 20 years, what some of the issues have been there, significant colleagues?
So the size of the department hasn't changed substantially over the years that I've been here, and we would be considered a middle-sized department. There are bigger ones, so if one went to Michigan, for example, the psych department is 50 faculty, whereas we're 35. There are schools, obviously, where there are only 20, so I would describe us as in the middle ranks. It's always had an excellent department reputation. We're always right on the cusp of the top 10, and it's in some years we cross over and we get into the top 10, in other years we're not. We're struggling this year to get ourselves back into the top 10 departments in the country. Part of that is name recognition. It's hard to beat out a Berkeley or a Stanford. They just instantly get voted high because they're Stanford or Berkeley. In terms of funding, if one uses funding as a criteria, we actually have as a department right now the most NIH grant money of any psychology department in the country, despite not being the biggest in numbers.
So, is that right?
Yeah, so that's one of our claims to fame.
So that's quite impressive, Chris.
I think, yeah, no, if you do it as a per capita, per faculty member, we're well endowed. And you know, if money and grants is a reflection of quality, then we're very good. And it was good when I came. Has been a huge amount of turnover since that time, retirements, people leaving. But the group of people who were young when I came and who grew to be famous in their respective areas has mostly stayed. And so I've really enjoyed the fact that I came up with a cohort of people who had arrived around the same time in the early to mid 80s, who each saw in their respective sub-discipline that they were rising as we all rose together. And so, for example, I mentioned the name off tape, Richard Davidson, came around the same time, and he's become probably the most renowned person in the department. But there were others, Carol Riff, Lynn Abramson.
Carol Riff, you're working with her on that aging project.
And I work, and since they're contemporaries, we're similar in age, similar in career trajectory, I've worked off and on with each of them. I've collaborated on two studies with Richie Davidson, which resulted in papers. I was a part of a mind-body center for 5 years with Richie Davidson. So it's been great to have people who you're friendly with, that you collaborate with, that happen to even be the same age as you, and are rising in their respective sub-disciplines. at the same time. So my relationship with the department, I would say, has been very positive throughout the whole time I've been here. I came with tenure. I didn't have the tenure struggle that many people have, which often sours their view of the university or the department. So I was spared some of that negativity. And instead, I was serving on tenure committees to tenure others, but not to actually have to go through that process myself.
Generally, has the department been congenial, not riven by professional or personal splits?
So the period before me had a different mix of people, and maybe academics were more ornery, irascible in that time period. So in the 70s, we had a reputation for being one of those departments that was difficult, especially for young people. Young people often thought this was an impossible department to continue to. That's not the story today, and it's not, definitely not the atmosphere today. It's been a much more collegial, congenial, amicable time period for the department. The world has changed. The culture of academics has changed. We're much more casual. More of the faculty are in jeans. You know, in earlier period, there was greater formality. Students addressed you not by your first name. You were Professor so-and-so, Mr. so-and-so. We've taken the names off the door. When I arrived, there were name tags on the door that said Mr. and your last name. I mean, there's just a greater informality. And I think that changed.
Students don't call you Chris, do they?
Some. Want to. And if they do, I don't mind. And if we're interacting regularly, if they work in the lab, I usually tell them at a certain point to start doing that. So that's changed the flavor of a department. There was a point we had, like most departments, a room where the faculty would meet, you know, when they would have faculty meetings. There was a time that was forbidden territory. A grad student or even a lecturer could not go into the room where the faculty met. That was sacred ground. That kind of barrier and division between the faculty and the staff, and the staff and the students, that is very different than it was in the 70s, 60s, 50s. So maybe that's what contributed to a more amicable department, although there are still departments that feud.
Yes.
I know the zoology department has had a reputation for discipline, sub-discipline wars. The anthropology department is, during the same time period that I'm saying was such a cultural revolution, during that same time period, they did succeed in having feuds despite the cultural change.
Yes.
So it may speak a little bit to the individuals. Across the discipline in other departments, social psych people don't always speak to biological. Biological don't always speak to clinical. Clinical don't always speak to the cognitive, and on and on and on. But we haven't quite had that sort of sub-discipline antagonism, which is not to say that there are never any issues which cause ill will.
Yeah.
There was a subgroup that wanted us to develop a sub-discipline of engineering psychology, human factors, and the faculty ultimately decided not to. And that led to a lot of ill will. I was among a group that wanted to develop us a major, a sub-discipline in health psychology. And initially the department moved in that direction, and then they got cold feet and pulled back. And I was disappointed. I don't hate my colleagues for that. I understood why they didn't want to. I personally think it would have been a good decision to have a sub-discipline, a sub-area group in health psych, but I couldn't convince everybody else to do that.
Did you ever aspire to lead the department? Or perhaps you will.
Yeah. We have a rotating chairmanship, which is every 3 years or so we have a new chair come in. And so I'm now in that age group where I would be one of the potential candidates to be. I'm not quite looking forward to it. I don't enjoy long meetings. And I'm not sure I really want to spend my day entirely solving the problems of others, which is what administrators often do.
Yes.
And I don't know if I really have a vision and aspiration for the department other than maybe this health psych area group that would make me want to become chair just so I could make that happen. I would say the best chairs are people who actually do have a particular agenda in mind. They want to accomplish something, and then they come into the position with that as their goal. So then one of the rewards for them when they're done is they've either grown the department, they created an area group, they hired some people. And I don't know if I have that particular aspiration. I have personal aspirations. I don't know if I have an aspiration for the department as a whole.
I take it that the department was supportive of your research and gave you leeway or a reduced teaching load as required?
Wouldn't that be nice? No. No, I have the responsibility of the same 2-course per semester load that everybody else in the department has, and I'm dependent upon grants to buy out that. No, I've never had any reduction in teaching as a consequence of the administration of Harlow, nor
really,
any reduction as, oh, I'm a great researcher or I have a lot of grants, therefore I should do less research. No.
And is that true for all your colleagues?
I'm not sure. I would say off and on over the years there probably have been some special arrangements made, but they tend to be not publicly discussed. And younger people coming in now, I think, unlike what happened to me, where you don't get a cost reduction when you're the first year, now it's not uncommon for a person coming in to not carry a full load the first year.
Who are some of the significant younger faculty who've come in the last 5 or 6 years?
I would say there's a husband-wife team, Seth Pollock, who's a clinical psychologist, child clinical, who studies kids who are maltreated from abusive families and kids who are adopted from institutional settings.
Uh-huh.
And his wife, Jenny Safran, studies language development, and not just language development, but even appreciation of music in young babies. Babies can appreciate music before they can speak. Mm-hmm. They can hear a major and a minor scale even before they know notes. So I would say there are some people like that, Jenny and Seth,
uh-huh,
who are definitely known to be players. They already are in people.
Uh-huh. What about the physical space for the department, Chris?
So I mentioned the size of the department of about 35 faculty, and that really is at the limits of the Brogdon building. The psych department hasn't been in Brogdon all that long, only since the early 1960s, but despite that, it's sort of outlasted its usefulness. And as with many of the buildings built in that time period, the university has decided it should come down, that it's not energy efficient, it's not fulfilling all its functions. And so psychology was supposed to move into a renovated Sterling, mm-hmm, hall when physics moved out. Physics has moved out, but this attempt to squeeze us into Sterling failed for a variety of reasons, one of which is, as the engineers reevaluated Sterling, it became clear that there really wasn't as much space in that building as we would need, because what the LNS wanted to do was actually squeeze psychology, astronomy, and a piece of physics into a renovated Sterling. And even though it's a big building, it wasn't that big. And so I had all the pleasure and the pain of spending a year heading the committee to see whether we could move into Sterling, literally going room by room, design by design, ultimately to have the plug pulled just recently, this fall, from that. And so psychology is now back in Brogdon for at least another decade. No, we will be
another
there.
Decade.
Well, you know, we don't move fast in this when it comes to buildings, unless there's a donor who's about to give $25 million or more. And we will be in Brogdon at least past 2015. Now, we were supposed to move into Sterling by 2010. We will stay in Brogdon to 2015, And the plan now is when they tear down Bardeen on Linden,
yes,
that they will try to create a new building for psychology there, but it would not even be considered until the time period 2017 and beyond. So later when we talk about my administrative and service functions for the university, among them was spending a year on the Sterling Space Committee, which led to a lot of paperwork, no end of long meetings, some great designs, but not a new plan for psychology to move into Sterling. Astronomy is staying in Sterling 1.
This concludes side 2 of tape 3.